Welcome. Thank you for joining us for another episode of FYI I Am Damaged. I'm joined by Enovi, a mental health advocate and motivational speaker. Welcome. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me. I'm really excited to be here today with you. Thank you.
You're welcome. You're welcome. Thank you for giving me your time. I know this was some time coming. I really appreciate you having you being here and sharing your story, your strengths, and most of all, your time.
Thank you.
Through our pre-interview, I feel I'm lucky to have you here with me to discuss your story due to the numerous events in your life that led you to this point of your journey. Surprisingly enough, it didn't start with addiction. Even though it's not the main focus, touch on the path that led you to the door of addiction.
So, you're right. Addiction is often a symptom of a bigger issue, right? And addiction has always been a thing going on in my life from little, from teeny tiny. I was really overweight. So that was there. And then family and genetics. My father, you know, was a pretty bad alcoholic, eventually losing his life to cirrhosis of the liver. And my mom's side of the family having a lot of alcoholism. So, you know, I definitely had some stuff go on. My dad was pretty abusive to my mom, and I was there for a lot of that. And then my grandmother, my father's mother, actually told her, like, I'm not, like, I love Enovi, that's my granddaughter, but I'm not dealing with you, because they had a really good relationship, but she threatened her, like, I'm not dealing with you, you're going to keep dealing with my son, he's treating you terribly, and it's hurting your daughter, you know. And that kind of encouraged my mom to leave him. My mom dated men. I was molested at like 5 or 6-ish. And was really afraid to tell her because he threatened her if I told. And then as I got a little older, I'll be honest with you, it just seemed like sexual abuse was kind of like a weird theme. Because I dealt with a lot of depression. I was diagnosed with depression at 15, and then when I got, you know, I kind of dealt with it, but you know how it is to be a Latino, we don't...
Yeah, it's never discussed. It's
never discussed. So, and, you know, my dad and I were pretty close. He definitely made a comeback in my life and did what he had to do. He tried his best, but he still struggled. And he struggled with his mental health a lot. And then as I got older, I was in college, and I was actually... My second year of college, I was raped by a friend. And also, I was also raped by a boyfriend. Like, literally, like, 6 months to the day. And it was just one of those things, like, I pressed charges on the friend. I did not press charges on the boyfriend. Because I couldn't rationalize in my head. I don't know. I think I made it right somehow, because that was my boyfriend. But I sat with it. I sat with this, like, self-loathing. I lost a lot of the weight. Then I was having a lot of, like, pains and aches and stuff, and was going to doctors trying to figure out, like, what's going on. And come to find out, I was diagnosed with Sjogren's syndrome. And they started to prescribe me pain medication.
Now, for those who don't know, what's that?
So Sjogren's syndrome is kind of like a sister to lupus. So it's an overproduction, obviously, you know, of the white blood cells, but it affects, like, your moisture. So you get this intense pain in the joints. It affects your eyes, your teeth, a lot of, like, your bones, mostly. So it's very painful at times, and you'll swell, and... It's just incredibly painful. It can be really painful.
So this feels like a slow, kind of like a slow snowball of everything that's happening. And you're basically getting hit left and right and up and down. And now with this full body pain, I'm guessing it's just, you just slide right into something else.
It's funny because I didn't want to take medication at first. I wouldn't take it. I was very against taking it. I had a really bad breakup, and I would realize that when I was going through something, I felt more pain. I kind of was able to put that those two things together. And I remember I had a really bad breakup. I felt pain, like, everywhere, and I was just like, I'm going to take a pill today. And that, for a good 7 years, I lived my entire addiction chasing that feeling I had that first time I took the pill. And no matter what drug I took, what drug I dabbled and messed with, nothing felt to me as good as that first time.
And this was this, which opiate was it?
Percocet.
Okay.
And it definitely snowballed into bigger things.
And I can sort of relate to a point, because I've Crohn's disease, and I have Crohn's disease, and there was one time I needed surgery for it, and there was something that the doctor prescribed to me was Endocit. So I'm guessing it was in the family of that.
Yeah.
Let me tell you something. That, I mean, I have my own issues with weight, my own issues with food, and honestly, I can tell you that is the only thing I wanted to feel again. So, and that was scary. And that was basically at the cusp of when people were describing the opioid addictions and the issues that are going on in the country. Mm-hmm. And I said, oh, shit. But it's the only thing that's in the back of my head of, like, I want that feeling again.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just fortunate that I just stayed away from it.
Yeah.
And I one time even asked the doctor, I was like, oh, I was prescribed this before. And he gives me this look.
Oh, and I know
he's
that
like,
look.
Yeah, he gives me this look. And he's like, how about you try something? How about some Tylenol or something like that? And I'm, luckily, I wasn't in that space to be pushy or whatever, mm-hmm. or be trying to get my way to get that. And luckily, he did that. And I'm like, you know what? So let me stop fucking with this.
Yeah, yeah.
And oof, but I know that want, that beginning want. And
I did that. The doctor shopping. Oh my god. Oh,
doctor
yeah.
Shopping.
Yeah, so doctor shopping is kind of like, well, so this was a while ago. So now, you know, they have different things in effect, so they'll red flag you, right. And it's a world, like, not a worldwide, but like, I believe it's a US thing, but I could be wrong. But they have a system where when they enter your name into it, it'll tell of any prescriptions you've gotten anywhere and who prescribed it and the number to contact. Yeah, that's now. Before, that wasn't an option. So I was able to go to this pain management doctor and get Percocet, and then go to the other pain management doctor and get Vicodin, and then go to the dentist later on and get more Percocet. And they'll give it to you as long as they were different milligrams or different types of opiates. So you can't, like, if I was your doctor and I prescribed you Percocet, you can't go somewhere else and get Percocet, you know, until a month later. But I would be able to give you morphine instead. So I would have just a ton of different types of medications at home. And towards the end of my addiction, when it got really, really, really bad, I was red flagged. Like,
wow.
Yeah.
I remember one time I went to the ER, and I maybe that was when this is in effect. This guy complaining about pain, all that, and we were in the ER. He's pain doctor. I need some stuff. Da da da. Doctor didn't believe him, holding him, pushing him back, basically. Just like, wait there, wait. And then all of a sudden, they're like, where's the guy? He ripped the IV out of his arm and left the ER because they didn't give him what he needed. He wanted some pain meds.
Yeah.
And they were going to give him some regular stuff. He's like, no, I need some other stuff. And they said, where the hell is he? And yeah, he just ripped the IV out of his arm and walked out. That was like that was the weirdest thing. And then I asked, I was like, what's that about? And it's like, no, I think the doctor was just dealing with somebody who was an addict who needed something. I was like, oh.
Withdrawal is horrible.
Yeah.
And when you're going through it, it's really uncomfortable. The most dangerous withdrawal you can go through is alcohol withdrawal. It's hands down the most dangerous withdrawal.
Yeah.
Opiate withdrawal is really, really, really uncomfortable, but most likely you're not going to die from it. It's just really, unless there's other things kind of lying underneath there. But it's uncomfortable. Like, where most people go through withdrawal for like 3 to 4 days.
Mm-hmm.
I went through withdrawal when I went to detox. It was 2 whole full weeks. Right. That's how many types of different opiates and drugs. And it was the worst. They had to literally sedate me for a majority of that time.
Wow. That, months.
It was really uncomfortable. I was taking the equivalent of, I mean, I did try heroin. I've definitely tried coke, and I would kind of play with it a little bit, but I was really scared, which was really silly, because honestly, what the doctors were prescribing me is the same exact thing.
Right.
Same thing. So I just, for whatever reason, I felt like, well, if a doctor is giving it to me, it must be safe.
Right.
I overdosed 4 times. It's a horrible way to live. You live every day doing the same thing over and over. It's like Groundhog's Day.
Now, that feeling from taking the opiates and then with heroin itself, where it basically comes, well, the heroin that comes from the opiates, is that a different feeling?
Not to me, no.
Or, no. I mean, I don't know the experience of, like, taking that. It's like the comparison. It's like you take heroin, you just, no, I'd rather take pills.
So my drug of choice, honestly, people are gonna be like, whoa, my drug of choice was fentanyl,
right?
Just pretty strong and dangerous.
Very
I have no idea how I'm sitting here today, honestly. But again, heroin wasn't like a big thing for me. It was, maybe I could count on one hand the amount of times I've tried it. Not many people know that, like, I've always kept that one really secret.
Right.
But it's more, in my opinion, from what I recall, it's more comparable to fentanyl. Like, they're very similar. Fentanyl was, I had to be very careful with it, because it definitely had me. I withdrew like twice over fentanyl.
And yeah, I mean, anybody listening, this is the whole point of it. Focus on somebody's strengths and what they go through. But touching on the journey and something like this, it's, people think addiction is clear cut. You're addicted to something, you got to go through recovery and then be strong about staying there. But this journey is very complex. It has many facets, and it's not easy because you have a very complex situation. You can have a very complex person, and those two complexities meeting each other don't always find a good outcome.
Right.
As we've seen with a lot of addicts. And you've been very fortunate,
because
you're here, you know, you're living your life, and we're sitting here under a beautiful tree,
right.
A beautiful day, and, you know, enjoying and celebrating life through the adversity that you did. And I wanted to touch on, which I forgot to touch on in the beginning, because this was just a chance meeting.
Right.
Because.
Right.
I see a couple of missed calls from my wife, and then I finally hit her. She's like, oh my God. I'm like, what the hell just happened? she goes to the pool, and I'm thinking something's happening, you know, or whatever. And she's with Mairena, which was, one of my other guests on the episode, and for the domestic violence. And they call me, and she's like, oh my God, I have somebody for you for the podcast. And I'm like, what happened? And she's like, oh my God. And she basically goes through this thing of saying, she's like, this lady thought, she's like, I thought this lady is going to think we're crazy. We're stalking her. She's like, we're in the line with her. And I think she was in the line with you at the concession stand.
Yep.
And then she took she was discussed, like, having a random talk with your mom.
Yep.
And then I think you guys sat next to each other somewhere. And she's like, oh my God, she's this lady's gonna think I'm crazy. We're always next to each other. She's probably gonna think I'm stalking her. And then, as her personality is, she strikes up a conversation with you.
Mm-hmm.
She's like, oh my God, babe, you know, she's gone through this, she's gone through that, and I think she'll be a wonderful guest for the podcast. And I'm just on the phone, like, okay, all right. I said, okay, so that's when, you know, information takes place, exchanges, and, you know, then we have our discussions, our pre-interview, and then here we are. I mean, talk about that day, and, you know, like, I mean, big up to my wife, RG.
It's like divine intervention, honestly. No, but that, you know, I have to just say, like, can we have a moment for your wife? 'Cause she's amazing.
She gets a lot of moments.
She's the best, okay? 'Cause we were on the line, and then, a few times. Uh-huh. And I was just like, I swear I'm not following you guys. And they kind of said the same thing.
Oh, so you felt that way too?
Yeah. I felt like I was following them. Oh. So I was like, I swear I'm not. I swear. And we just kind of had a laugh. And there was this beautiful young lady that walked by, full figured girl, but very neat, so uh-huh. pretty. And I said to my mother under my breath, I wish I had that type of confidence. Mm. And she turned around, your wife turned around and was just like, and why do you not? Why not? And I'm just like, wait, huh? She's like, if you want to wear it, wear it. It would look great on you. And just started yeah. kind of like feeding my soul. Mm-hmm. And that's when we started this conversation. And I was just like, you know, it's so funny you say that because I do motivational speaking mm-hmm. and I needed you to motivate me right now. She's like, it's all right. We always give it, but don't take it, right? And I'm just like, you're dead on. But it was so encouraging and inspiring, and I felt so comfortable talking to her.
Right.
And that's when she was just like, I have to connect you to my husband because I think you'd be perfect.
That's her in a nutshell.
Her best friend was, I forgot her name, I'm sorry.
Amarena.
Yeah. She was just like, yes, you have to. And she kind of shared some of her story. And it was really nice. And their yeah. energy is just incredible. When you know, when like that intuition chick kicks in and you're just like, yeah, these are good people.
Oh, really yeah. good people. Argue that's the lady at the bus stop that, you know, you'll strike a conversation yep. with, you know, and she just talk and then... I love that about her. You know, sometimes it's like, babe, we gotta go, this and that. Yeah. You know, oh, hit me up on Instagram, da, 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 da. Yeah. And, you know, you talk about it later.
It sounds like my husband all the time. You talk too much. You just. So I completely understand. But she's just, something about her is just so comforting. And I think it's both of y'all. You know, right. it's just, you guys are really comforting. The energy is amazing. And I'm just like, here's my life story. You know, like I went through ABC 1-3 and she's just like, oh my gosh. But she's really, really an encouraging woman. And, mm-hmm. you know, you guys are both just incredible. And I appreciate
Thank you.
It.
Thank you.
Like, I appreciate your time too and her time and inviting me here.
Hey, look, this is a lot of heavy lifting. There's a lot of intricacies in it, but I see the potential in it. And you know, like I said in the beginning, I'm just glad you're able to share your time with me because it's hard for a lot of people. A lot of people are not comfortable. They're comfortable with taking everything in, but not sharing theirs. And you know, people have to treat this like a library that you have to subscribe, but participate and contribute to. Because if you don't, then There's not that much content that people are gonna experience to learn from.
That's true. That's a really good analogy. That makes sense. It definitely yeah. makes sense. Yeah.
You know, and to continue on, some, if not one of those events that you've gone through would have tore, if not all the events, you know, it just would have obliterated a person, you know, to their core. But you've maintained. So what was that driving factor to stay strong? Especially, I know we may be glossing over a few things, but we can go back and forth. But with the objective to stay clean, how do you show yourself up? What's one of the things that just keeps you strong and keeps you away from things that is not conducive to a good life?
That's a really good question. My family. Hmm. And this is going to sound really, 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 really selfish. Myself.
Of course. That's where it starts.
Yeah. I think my whole life I've been dealing with low self-esteem, not feeling good enough, not feeling like I amounted enough. Mm-hmm. My mom is a very strong personality, but I'm kind of the person, like, even though I'm very happy-go-lucky and I can strike a conversation with anybody, I love to help people.
Right.
I sometimes fade in the background, especially with the group of women in my family. They're very strong and very out there and very... So my mom has a very, very, very strong personality. And I remember growing up, she was always saying, like, you have to love yourself. You have to love yourself. Mm-hmm. But engaged in behaviors that didn't always show that. So it was more like, and I knew what she was doing. Sometimes you have to do the whole fake it till you make it.
But did she know you were watching, or she didn't realize you were watching to be like, I'm saying one thing, but doing another?
I don't think she realized it.
Okay.
I think we're also dealing with the whole idea of generational curses, and we're dealing with trying to change the paradigm and really, you know, or tilt it and try to make it different. Like, even down to the man I married was nothing like my father.
Right.
The complete opposite. And don't get me wrong, I was the girl that dated the drug dealer. I was the girl that wanted to save the guy, you know. And that's the way my mom is, you know. Growing up, I that didn't work. It didn't work. And I just always saw my mom kind of putting out more than she got.
Right.
I made a conscious decision, like, okay, I'm not going to, it's going to sound weird, I'm not going to go for this because this didn't work for me before.
Right.
And, or I would see certain traits in a man that was more like my dad. And I was just like, I can't do this for the rest of my life. As head over heels in love I was with this person, I just felt like I can't do this back and forth, this insecure, this all of this. And my father told me these words once. Never go for a man that you are head over heels in love with. That is, and you're constantly like thinking about them and wanting them and all that.
Right.
And I'm just like, but isn't that what you want? Like the love, the excitement? Absolutely not. He was like, absolutely not. That's insecurity. That's fear. That's wondering what they're doing, wondering if they're thinking about you. That shouldn't even be a thought. It should just flow.
Right.
You want to be with somebody who matches your energy and makes you feel comfortable and makes you feel validated and makes you feel seen. And it doesn't have to be this over the top, crazy, passionate thing.
No, you're right. And even then, that takes a working up to.
Yeah.
Because people, their gears do need to match up, but then that sinking takes time, that takes learning, that takes real love.
Yes.
And not just like how you said, it's like the infatuation.
Yep.
Of wanting, you don't want an infatuation with a person, you want that love, and through that love you'll find synchronicity, and the synchronicity, you guys be on the same page, whether it's like, okay, I'm taking out the garbage, you doing the dishes, this and that, we sit down, watch a movie. You know, when it happens, but you know,
and I mean, you know, we're family people. Growing up Latina and Latinos, like we're raised as women, you know, we're already on mommy track from three, you know, like,
oh my God.
You know, we, a cocinar, a limpiar, you know what I'm saying? Like we're already taught that.
Yeah.
And so at my instinctual way of life is to serve, right? And to be submissive. And I was constantly going for these men that I had to serve and be submissive to, and realizing this is not working.
There's an addiction in that as well.
Yes,
you know, it's
that validating feeling and the chase
and then the
trauma bond of it all.
For all the people around a woman, and it's like, oh, I have to show them that I'm doing stuff for my man. And I think I mentioned it before in other ones I've just had discussions, and long time ago, RJ and I would be talking, and we would be at a party, and I'm a product of a single family, a single parent household, have to do for myself. And then I told her, I said, I don't need you to do for me.
Right.
I remember it was at a party once, and I'm hope I'm keeping true to what I said before, but they would tell her like, oh wait, she's the party monster. Forget it. She's dancing. She can complain that her feet hurt, but then she'll be dancing till everybody has to leave the party.
Right.
And you
feel like
know,
you're talking about me and my husband.
that's RZ as well.
Yeah.
And you know, she kills it. Doesn't matter. You know, because that's her, and that passion of hers to do that. Like, I love and I admire it, because you know, in certain points, I'm slowly getting out of it. But that's the majority of it isn't me.
Right.
And it's hard to try and get that across and have her understand it, but she does understand it, and it goes back and forth. But the point is that we were at a party, I'm getting my own plate, I'm playing with our firstborn, I'm playing with the baby and doing this and that, she's dancing, chilling, having a good time. And they're like, one was like, he got his own plate,
right?
and he's playing with the baby. While all, like, some of the women are, like, they're serving for their man. They're watching the kids, and the guys are just chilling and, you know, shooting the shit and this and that. Maybe dancing occasionally. And I think one of her cousins was like, wait, he takes care of the baby? He what, you know, and right. She's like, yeah, you know,
that's his son.
How he does. Right. That's him, you know, not a person like I don't treat every seat that I sit on as a throne. Like, no, it's I've always kept the thing of 50-50. And then I seen that, and then you describing all that stuff, I'm like, wait, even that's an addiction that some of these ladies prescribe to. To me, I find it as a shame, but hopefully they can see that and be like, you know, no, I'm more than this. Like, we have to hold this weight of the family.
Right. And I learned what a true man is as I got way older and as I got married. And I think I always thought that a real man was like possessive or protective, quote unquote, will fight for you, could be loud, could be boisterous in your face, all of that, will get upset if you go somewhere without him, what you wear, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But when I was nearing the end of my addiction, my husband, we had no money, he lost his job, I lost my job. He literally did deliveries, because they didn't have like Uber as that yet at that time, so he was doing deliveries in different like pizza shops. And we're talking about, he's an engineer, but that wasn't even a thing. Like, he did deliveries, he did whatever he had to do, if anything it was that was legal, he did it. Where I was so used to somebody like, well, I need quick money, let me go, you know, flip a few bricks and then I'll have a few $1,000 or whatever.
Yeah.
He didn't do that. He worked his ass off, excuse my language, but he worked his ass off just to make sure that we were okay. Mm-hmm. And as I got older and as we grew together, you know, I started to really see that all that other stuff is not, you know, what a real man is, you know?
Are you seeing this through your dealing with addiction, or this is post?
Both, because I was in it
right
at the same, like towards the end of my addiction. At the end of it, I'm watching him kind of like do all of this to make me okay, and then make our family okay, you know, because we had his kids, my son wasn't born at this time. I just saw everything he did, and it inspired me to also want to stop using.
Nice.
Because I felt like, well, I'm gonna be okay.
Yeah.
Because that was what I was afraid of. I don't want to feel that pain, because I was just so tired of pain. And don't get me wrong, my life wasn't terrible. Like, there were times that were really fun and really beautiful. And, you know, I remember times driving with my dad. And I think of it all the time, you know, like, where he was really silly and funny and with Cinquito Nieves in the car and banging on the steering wheel. And it was great. You know, we go to Six Flags, just him and I. We go have lunch every Wednesday. We had great times. But there were tough times. And I just saw the dedication that he had into making sure that our family was okay, that it inspired me. It did two things. It made me feel incredibly worthless, because I felt like, well, I'm just a burden on this man.
Right.
But he never complained about it. And then it also made me feel incredibly inspired, because I felt like he's not complaining about it. He'll let you know when he's bothered. He's that type. So, I knew that he wasn't saying anything negative. So, he was just rolling with the punches. He wanted to support me, but didn't totally know how to. And the day that I got clean, I remember, you know, I was either going to live or die that day. And I chose to die, believe it or not. I was going to OD on, like, Tylenol.
Right.
And I had made a call 20 days before to a rehab. And they called me that same, the moment I put the pills in my mouth. The phone rang, and it was that. It was the rehab. It was the weirdest thing. And I told him, and he's like, I support whatever you have to do. I'll be there soon. I'm leaving. You know, because he was doing, like, I think he actually had a job at that point, like a more stable job. And he just, like, dropped everything just to, like, be there for me.
Right.
And I think in that I learned a lot of what a real man does. And, you know, it's not about the fighting. It's not about getting a quick money or going to jail, and a real woman doesn't need to hold down her husband while he's in jail. Like, that's not even needed, you know. And it inspired me to get clean.
That right type of support.
Right. Cool. Right. Cool. And it was consistent, and it was peaceful. And I never felt scared that I had my moments where I feel scared that he would leave me because of what I was doing and then my addiction and stuff, but he unconditionally loved me through that. Like, there was no thinking on his part. It was never even a, like, he never threatened divorce. I did, you know, I was that person. I was like, I'm not good enough, like, we should get divorced. Or, like, I did a lot of self-loathing.
Right.
And he was just like, girl, bye. Like, I'm not going anywhere, you know, like, we're here, we're in it, we're gonna do this, you know. So for somebody to deal with a woman in that capacity, it takes a lot of strength, especially as a man, especially in our culture. And although he's not the same culture, but that takes a lot. And I grew to really respect him more than I had already respected him, you know.
No, that's a beautiful thing.
Yeah.
Now, when stepping back a little bit, when using took a hold of you and when it became second nature to your life, how was that discussion in your head to rationalize that this is normal in your view day to day?
That's a really good question. Ooh. Okay.
I try.
That
I
was
try.
A good one.
I try.
So I'm very impulsive. It's a really bad quality. It can be good. It could be good sometimes. But I'm really impulsive. So honestly, the way I rationalized it, like every only child, I'm an only child, I don't have any siblings, I would just say, I'm going to just do this. I'm just going to do it. There was no complete rationalization. I think the most rationalization I did was, well, a doctor started giving it to me.
Mm. Right.
Right? So I was constantly going through my prescriptions. I never lasted the whole month for the pain medication ever.
Right.
And, you know, for me, it was what I needed. I also used to get, like, pain-induced seizures. So, because I would be in so much pain. Now, looking back, it was probably withdrawals.
Okay.
But they thought it was pain-induced seizures, and
so they kept giving you more, more pain.
But I was going right through them a weekend. And when I tell you, it was a lot. Like, I was taking maybe 250 milligrams of opiates 3 times a day.
Wow.
Yeah, it was really bad. I just did it. I just said, well, doctor started giving it to me. I don't want to have a seizure, but I'm going to do whatever I need. And I did whatever I had to do to get it.
And that became your new normal.
Yeah. Every day I woke up to get drugs.
Now, did you float the line between functional and full-blown addict? I think before when either you mentioned or we discussed that you function fine.
To a point. I thought I did. I didn't. It was very obvious, and I didn't realize that at the time. Towards the end of my addiction, my entire life just revolved around it. There was no way you couldn't tell. It just became everything. I was so obsessed with it. And literally, I would get anxiety knowing, like, I would plan it out in my head, and I would get this intense anxiety knowing on this day I'm most likely gonna run out. What do I have to do to get it? And the insanity of it is that I spent thousands of dollars on this.
Wow.
And the things that I could have saved for, you know what I mean? Like, that's just crazy. Looking back, especially.
How was that addition in your head? Why did you just stop and be like, wait a minute, I spent this much on this much and this time and is it incalculable, or you actually hit a number? Or
I've hit a number. I'm not ready to say it. It's heavy.
No, that's...
It's a big number. I think I still live with a lot of guilt for that one.
Right. Right.
It was big. And I somehow just made it right. That was what I was saying. And it sounds so horrible now as I look back. But that was my perspective on it. It was just like, oh, wow. Like, I'm just going to do it and not fully think about it. And then when I would feel guilt, I'm already high. So I feel like guilt, but oh, well. You know, it was very counterintuitive. It was very strange.
And that's the other part people don't see of, like, literally feeding an addiction.
Oh, yes.
You know, it's people think, you know, it's like, where does the money come from? And it wherever it comes, it goes to that.
Yes.
And
so,
people really don't really see the cost until somebody brings it up. So I'm sure if people could do the numbers in their head and they see over the course of the years, look, this it does add up. They talk about how many people are addicted, how much they take, and all that comes with the addiction, except for the money factor that goes straight into these pharmaceutical companies'
yes.
wallets.
Yes, 100%. It's really painful to see.
Yeah.
You know, and it's horrible. And your life revolves around it, you know. And the other thing is that addicts, a lot of people misconstrue and just like, oh, you, why can't you just stop? Why can't you just go to rehab? Why can't you do this? The rehabs are overflooded. It is. I made a call 20 days before the wow. day I got clean. 20 days. I did it on my birthday, February 3rd. And they called me February 23rd, 2015 at 5:47 p.m. Wow. I will never forget that. That doctor, and I still see the same doctor to this day. He's mm-hmm. been a very, like, a guiding light for me.
Right.
And, you know, but people don't realize, like, we don't want to be an addict. Like, I never wanted to be an addict. It gets to a point where you have to use so you're not sick.
Right.
So, you know, and people look at people like us, you know, me and addiction, and we're just like, why would you do all that? Like, that's a lot, you know. Yeah. You're jumping through hoops. I'm gonna be honest with you, the worst thing I did, one of the worst things I did, was stole my mother's rent money and helped her look for it.
Wow.
Helped her with her,
right?
Like, it's not here. Like, and I still have a lot of shame about it, you know, and I've definitely paid my dues to her. Mm. You know, but that was a rent. Like, how do you do that? That's really fucked up.
I can attest to that. Well, I can attest to experience that because we've had addicts in our family on my mother's side, and it was when those little portable TVs came out. I think my sister wanted one. I forgot. I don't know if my mother or my father got it for her, and I think if I recall, like either my uncle or my aunt, I forget who, it was a long time ago. Like, they stole it, and they sold it for drugs.
Yep.
And, you know, that was our first experience with dealing with what an addict would do to support their habit.
Yeah.
And it wasn't a good feeling. We saw what it did to my mom and her dynamic with her family, and it wasn't a beautiful thing.
A lot of people don't realize that. I mean, we do know. Okay, so we know that addiction affects families.
Mm-hmm.
What happens is that this can be controversial to say, being the addict. I don't believe it affects the addict the most.
No, you're right.
Yeah, I believe it affects the family more.
Absolutely.
Than anything.
Yeah.
As the addict, we get clean. We get praised after we get clean. The attention is amazing because we feel so accomplished. It's a difficult experience. But what a lot of people don't realize is that then the family is sitting there with all the damage that we've done.
Right.
Right? And they feel like, well, I have to forgive this person because they're now clean. No, you don't. I do believe in the whole idea of it's good to forgive. It gives you the freedom. But it's really important to be able to identify the pain that you have,
right,
in order to heal and move past it. And I don't think that any support system should ever feel guilty about that. And a lot of people do.
Right.
Because it's really difficult, you know, because I also was the family member of an addict too, although I was the addict as well, my father.
Right.
You know, and my father never really sat with me and was just like, I'm so sorry for what I put you through. He never did that. I knew he was, but, you know, that was me and finishing college and studying psychology and having a case that, you know, like, at this point in my life.
Mm-hmm.
But people don't usually...
Do you feel he did it in other ways?
My dad, he was rough. So he was either really happy or really miserable. There was really no in between. I think he tried to do it in the best way he knew how to.
Right.
He definitely made his apology on his deathbed.
Okay.
Literally the day he was dying. Because my parents were still legally married, although they were not together, they were separated. My father literally held my mom's hand and told her, I never stopped loving you. Like, he was still in love with my mom.
Wow.
Imagine that. Yeah. Imagine living, 25 years, give or take? Because when he passed away, I think I was 30 when he passed away. So you're living 25 years, give or take, in love with someone who's just, you abuse them.
Wow.
And you hurt them, and he did a lot to her. And she never uttered a bad word about that man. I've always respected her for that.
It's a weird dynamic where that type of thing a person deals with. Did that, going through that and him making his apologies on his deathbed, did that take more of a toll on her, the apology, than the actual abuse that his addiction made him do? Or just, it was a product, the what he did to her, which was a product of his addiction, like, how was she able to manage that? Nobody focuses on that side.
Right, it's true.
So did she ever confide in you, like, the apology fucked me up more than the abuse?
So I think that she actually was really grateful for the apology. Okay. I think it did a lot for her. It fucked me up.
Mm.
I felt like, what the fuck? You gonna do this now? With all the time we had, you gonna do this now?
So she reconciled with it, but you couldn't.
I couldn't. And I was really mad at him because I felt like, how could you do this? My son is a year and a half. You're barely in this child's life. Now you're leaving. And I've done everything for you. Wiped this man's ass. Lived with him practically.
Mm-hmm.
And now you're going to sit here and apologize to us when all you had to do was stop doing this. So here's the weird part. When I'm very contradictory, I'm saying, like, addicts don't want to be addicts. Mm-hmm. Is we do this because we feel like we have to do it.
Right.
But as a child to an addict, I felt like, well, why did you put me through that? The difference, and here's where I tried to shift in the generational curse, what I went through was, my son never met me as an addict. I was clean 2 years prior to him.
Right.
And I'm really grateful that I was able to do that for him, because he'll never know that woman. You know, she's dead. She's totally dead.
Okay.
But my father, I knew that. Right. And he's dead. He's totally dead. And I don't feel like I'm better than my dad in any capacity or below him. It's something like that. It was just something that I chose to do knowing what I went through.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a long time I felt really angry at him. But I tend to be the kind of person that tries to look at the positive side of things, right, more than not. And I wanted so badly not to be mad at him. I really wanted to just perceive it in a more positive light.
Mm-hmm.
But I was really mad. I was just really pissed off. Like, you're doing this now? Why couldn't you do this before?
Right.
You know, but he ended up in that situation because he stopped using and drinking when my son was born. Because he wanted to be there for my son.
Right.
So I felt like that was one of the greatest acts of love my father could have done. And I guess that goes back to the question of, has he ever really apologized? I think that was probably his showing, or, okay, or his attempt to show that he was sorry. But I okay, you know, when he died, I felt really mad at him about that, because I was just like, why didn't you do this sooner, you know?
Right.
And then my mom is sitting there like, oh, you know, he said sorry, you know, and I'm just like,
maybe that's what she was waiting
for.
Yeah,
I think, you know, she needed that, though. He wasn't good to her. He was horrible to her. And she never, ever, ever uttered a bad word to him. I had no idea what went on. I knew what I saw.
Right.
A lot of stuff I don't remember. I remember one incident that was really bad. He tried to kill me. He tried to kill us both. He threw a lamp at the wall. Long story short, he threw a lamp at the wall. He did that on purpose, and he admitted that. And the lamp shattered, but one of the pieces of it was kind of like sticking up, and I landed on it. So it pierced me, you know. My mom just grabbed me and had to run. You know, we lived on Gun Hill.
Yeah.
So she literally ran with one of the people that we lived in the building. He was a police officer, ran all the way to Montefiore with me.
Mm-hmm.
And thank God, you know, but it was scary, you know. So he put me through a lot. But, you know, when my son was born, he definitely showed me, like, I'm going to try and do this differently.
Mm-hmm.
And I was grateful for that. It meant a lot to me.
Okay.
You know, and he did what he had to do to get himself back in my life and take those steps. And it wasn't always great. He was a piece of work.
Yeah.
He dealt really badly with his mental illness. There were times he would just leave me places. Like, if we were driving upstate, he would just leave me because he was just mad. or whatever he was mad about. He was really mad that I was molested when I was 5. He dealt with a lot of guilt because of that. And I always knew that he was going to bring that up, start drinking, and then somehow still take it out on me. So it was very strange. But when my son was born, that changed. He really tried to kind of, I guess, make do what he did to me. So,
to help those identify and help their loved ones should they feel someone is hiding their addiction from them, what can they look for to help them determine if this is happening?
So, a change in personality, definitely. Nodding. A lot of nodding. So, one thing, if the person is a smoker, one thing you can look at is if they smoke in the car or like in certain areas, check for cigarette burns around, because what happens is that they're nodding off and they'll probably have a cigarette in their hand and it'll burn down and it'll fall.
Not the addiction of regular smoking, but what there's just smoking, but they're an addict, and then you just see burn marks everywhere.
Right.
Because they're nodding because of
the drugs.
Yeah.
Yeah, but usually the cigarette intensifies that high.
Gotcha.
So a lot of people who don't even smoke like that, but they use drugs, will start smoking because it intensifies the high. But you'll start to notice around them, like burns in their shirts, like even cigarette burns on themselves, their hands. Burns on the seats, the car, always the car.
And also the act of if they're not a smoker and then they start smoking. That's a byproduct.
Yeah. Not always, but what I've seen.
But if you see a person who's never smoked in their life and then all of a sudden they go through some shit and then, wait, you're smoking now? And then I see this, then, okay, that's a good...
Yeah. Very dramatic weight loss. So there's a weird thing that happens. Like, your skin looks like gray. It's weird. So, I can't even explain it. But you'll be able to see a difference in their skin tone and a difference just in, like, how you can almost see the veins in their hands, you know, and always the age-old track marks.
Right.
So, and it looks, they look like little mosquito bites with, like, you know, like a little
vein coming from it or something like
that. It could be, or like a mosquito bite with a tiny little scab right in the middle of it. That's a track mark. And you'll see them around in the between their toes, their fingers, because they're trying to hide it.
Right.
Even in their neck sometimes. The biggest thing is the track marks, the nodding, weight loss, even personality. Opiates kind of... Long-term opiate use, at first it kind of makes you tired, you know, and you fall asleep. But long-term, you'll notice an increase in their behaviors. And, like, they almost become, like, erratic. It really affects your mental health drastically.
Like, sort of like in a manic type of sense?
Yes.
Or,
yeah. Okay. Like, almost like bipolar, but not.
Right.
Not so much, like, because not in a mania of bipolar, but just, like, excited, like. Like ADHD type.
Okay.
That's probably a better...
Gotcha. Okay.
And the other thing that is very strange, sugar. Addicts...
Another drug.
Right. Right. When we use opiates, you need sugar. I don't know why. Usually it's like the fruity candies, the sour candies, the Starburst, stuff like that. A lot of drug addicts who use opiates need sugar. And that also, I believe, if I remember correctly, the reason why is because scientifically it increases your high. Sugar kind of has the same effect. It binds to your opiate receptors. So, you know, it kind of just makes you feel like, you know, and that's like why, you know, kids get a little hyper when they eat sugar.
Yeah. Kinda, hyper on top of that addiction. Yeah. It's I'm sure.
But if you notice them, you know, eating a lot of candy,
right,
and you're noticing other stuff, you're like, okay, there's something going on here for sure. And if you ask them to do a drug test and they get offended, if you're not hiding anything, you shouldn't get offended.
True, especially on that point.
Mm-hmm.
Now, do you feel going through your past traumas prior to the addiction kind of softened you up to addiction, or was it the physical response to it? Now, I know we're probably just it's a touching back and forth, but a lot of people, because people can argue that, okay, I've been through this, I've been through that, which, you know, I can attest to, and other than, but there's also little addict things that people do.
Right.
Like with myself, it's probably, I would narrow it down to food.
Mm-hmm.
But I've been through my past traumas, and I haven't gone through the weighty effect of being addicted to those type of drugs.
Right.
But do you think, in your perspective, because we're focusing on you, mm-hmm. that you think you would have reached that point of this type of addiction because of what you've been through? Or was it a chance thing that you going through everything that you did, these past traumas, then your introduction or being around these type of drugs, and say, hey, fuck it.
Right.
You know, I mean, was there any kind of correlation? Or it's just a chance thing that you just started using?
So, I do... Yes and no.
Okay.
So, I think that had I not gone through what I went through, I don't think I would have picked up a drug.
Okay.
However, I do believe that it made me... I believe that there's so much addiction in my family that there's definitely... It's definitely like a hereditary thing.
Right.
You know, it's a disease, and there's actually a gene for it. You know, mm-hmm. it's in your DNA. And I had it from both sides. I may not have had the addiction to opiates, but maybe it would have went back to food.
Right.
You know, I think I've been dealing with addiction since I was like 5. You know, and that's kind of ironic because I went through, you know, sexual abuse at 5.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that was just my way to cope with that.
Right.
Once I found this medicine and I saw how good it made me feel, I stuck to that. But I think I was preconditioned, but like maybe predisposed,
right,
to possibly having an addiction because mm-hmm. the gene kind of runs in both sides of my family.
Okay.
So
I mean, it's I'm sure people can talk on both sides about it,
right.
But it's always, I feel there's always something there, and it's definitely there on both sides, because
yeah.
people want to, they don't want to be stressed all the time. They don't want to feel the way they feel,
right.
And they find an outlet. And sometimes those outlets are very severe. And it's addiction. And people don't yeah. see it for what it is.
And most of us have a vice.
Yeah.
You know, some people have a healthier vice, working out, walking, talking, maybe working a lot. You know, unfortunately.
We know those people that OD'd in the gym and everything.
Yeah.
Like, you're a little
yeah.
bit addicted to it.
And there's also a lot of people that don't, you know, they have had mom and dad be drug addicts. They grew
right.
up in really horrible, you know, conditions. But they never touched a drug. And they mm-hmm. live really great lives, you know.
Right.
And kudos, you know, I think that's amazing.
Yeah.
I couldn't do that. I could now, but I wasn't able at that point to do
right.
it. I don't think I was taught healthy coping skills either.
Mm-hmm.
So that makes things a little different. You know, I didn't know
right.
how to deal with life. I dealt with it. That's another thing. Like, I just never felt totally comfortable expressing myself.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of sat with a lot. And I think I needed something to just make me feel better.
Right.
So had I had a comfortable place to talk and feel more comfortable and feel like nobody's gonna leave me and just take off on me, because I
right.
always had this fear of abandonment, maybe I wouldn't have ever became an addict. You know, maybe I would have had healthy coping skills, but I didn't
right.
have healthy coping skills. For me, I've always been a people pleaser. I always wanted people to like me. It was just always about everybody else, and I never really thought like, well, how did this hurt me? How did this affect me?
Right.
It was always like, well, I can't say this because then so-and-so is not going to like me anymore.
And it lends to the fact that different people, it's different for everyone.
Right.
There's so many facets. There's no one size fits all. And all that talk, and people need to realize that it has to be a dynamic way of helping somebody who's in this sort of space.
Yep.
There's no one true way of doing it. And and you know, great respect to the people such as yourself that help people try and get past either their addictions or their traumas and everything. describe the tilt or the tipping point that led you to the path of recovery.
So I was just doing really horrible things, and I had to look at myself in the mirror. Mm-hmm. Like I had mentioned before, I felt like I was a burden. So on February 23rd, 2015, I found myself on the bathroom floor. Mm. I had pills in one hand and I had the phone in the other. 20 days prior to that date, I had made a phone call. Shout out to Dr. Vando, because he's still my doctor to today. He's great. But I found myself on the bathroom floor and I just felt like I was a burden. I felt like I just couldn't get it right. I was waiting for this call. And then I felt like I was never gonna get it, and I felt like, why? I can't even imagine being clean. Like, not me.
Yeah.
The noise in my head was just too loud to deal with on my own. Mm-hmm. And I just wanted to die, you know? So I stuffed the pills in my mouth that day, and I was about to swallow, and then I got that call. I think when I started this, I didn't think it was going to be long term. Mm-hmm. I fully expected to find a better way to use. Mm-hmm. I was trying to find a way so I wouldn't run out of my medications and a better way to use, you know?
Right.
I just kind of kept taking each day as it came. Mm-hmm. And I woke up one day and I have 7.5 years sober, you know?
That's awesome.
And, but I think what really started that process was, you know, I think we had our second or third miscarriage. I really wanted to be a mom. Mm-hmm. But I wasn't being even a good stepmom or wife. It was really selfish. I only thought about myself.
Right.
But I also had a lot of self-loathing, and it's very strange. Like, you're not doing anything productive, but you hate yourself. And I just felt like I wasn't making any positive contributions into the life of my family, my mom, my dad, my husband, my stepchildren. And I felt like they would be significantly better without me.
So that all that just ended up to that tipping point of right. You doing that, but then you're getting that call. And
Then
from then on there, that started the...
Yeah.
Okay. Now, how important is... And you touched on it before, but maybe you can expand on it. The how important it is the support to someone beginning in that inception of being serious about recovery?
I think it is the most important thing you can receive. A lot of people use because we feel alone.
Right.
We want to escape that feeling, like the noise in our head. I had a lot of consistent support. I'm really lucky. A lot of people don't have what I have or had even. Mm-hmm. I had like an army and a tribe just kind of get together behind me. I was like, we're going to do this. When they knew I was serious.
And you this know. Is just family, friends and family. Yeah. You have love.
More so my mom, my husband, my stepdad.
Okay.
I think the most important thing when you're dealing with a family and addiction is go to Al-Anon. It's really important. Because you can't tell that person you're mad at them just yet.
So and Al-Anon, for those not knowing.
Al-Anon is it's kind of like AA or NA for the family.
Right.
So you get to go and you kind of go by the 12 steps. Mm-hmm. But you're doing it for family and support givers and caregivers of people in addiction.
Oh, and so the support group for those supporting those recovering through addiction. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's awesome.
Al-Anon is amazing. Mm-hmm. And it helps because so many people go through these experiences, but they're going through it alone. And you do need support. The support needs support.
Absolutely.
And it's really important with that too, because when somebody is in recovery and they just stepped into it, you can't yet tell them that you're mad at them.
Right.
Although that's okay to be mad at them. So they can't hear that just yet. They need to hear all of the, you got this, I believe in you, I'm going to hold you, it's okay.
Yeah.
And in time, I would actually say a year later, mm-hmm. a year of consistent sobriety, then you can start to tell the person that they've hurt you. The best way I think to do it is to write a letter the day that they get sober.
Right.
when you see that they've been consistent 6 months a year, you can have that conversation and let that letter be a blueprint. But definitely support needs support. And absolutely, just take it easy and be kind to yourself and be patient with yourself. It's okay to be mad at the addict. Mm-hmm. That's okay. There's nothing wrong with that. You have every right and you should be. I'd be very surprised if you weren't mad at the addict. You know, I'd be very shocked.
Right.
You have to be almost. You know, I'm not trying to tell people what to do, but it's important to feel that. You got to feel these things.
Yeah, you have to. That's something that has to be put into light, because everyone, and it's natural for somebody to feel, in a sense, and maybe I don't know if I'm using the right word, but to feel jealous that, oh, they're getting all the shine because they're, but look what the fuck they did to me,
right?
You know, yep. And they're upset, and even though somebody might say, oh no, that's not something you should be feeling, they should be supported, and then they don't feel supported,
right?
So that support for the support is amazing, and people need to realize that. If you're supporting someone that's going through something so hefty, you know, there is something there for you as well, so that they could process. And I think that's an amazing thing.
Al-Anon has saved people, because a lot of people, you know, a lot of people supporting people in addiction tend to be like very empathetic people, empaths, people that are people pleasing, you know, and also the addict tends to be people pleasing. You're the same. It's right. The weirdest thing. So you're exactly the same. You guys mirror each other. And you know, at the same time, you're like, I almost hate you right now, but I have to love you through this process, especially in early recovery. Early recovery is really tough for family members, because you don't trust anything they say. I'm 7.5 years sober, and I still, to this day, you know, my husband says it's a little bit much, but to this day I still have to take the extra step to do stuff for my mom so she feels more comfortable. She will randomly, very random, just because she hasn't really dealt with it,
right,
she will randomly just be like, oh, I don't believe that you're working today. And I'm like, I'm in court. Like, what do you mean? I'm at work right now. I'm about to go to court. Like, I'm gonna go inside. I can't talk to you right now. And I'll take the extra step to send her like a video, like, hi mama, you said ABC 123 and look, I'm here,
right?
You know, or doing other little things that I know that work for her. But it's hard, you know. And as an addict, we have to be okay with understanding that we may have to make rebuild that trust for a long time.
Exactly.
Maybe indefinitely.
Okay.
That's okay. Addiction is a betrayal.
Right.
It's a cheat. You know, you betrayed the people around you, because we do a lot of things that are horrendous. We lie, we cheat, we steal. We don't want to, but it's the only thing we know to do. We have to spend a significant amount of time making that up. And that's okay.
And that's a whole nother journey within itself that takes just as long to recover from than recovery.
Right. And I think it's okay for the addict to be mad about that too.
Right.
But if I could ever give a piece of advice to anybody out there who's in even like midterm recovery, like maybe they have a few years in, just do it. It starts to really rebuild the trust. It makes your life a lot easier. Mm-hmm. Don't go crazy. I tend to go overboard just because my family's a little different. But, you know, you do what you can and you just try to rebuild that trust. Mm-hmm. It'll help you in the long run for sure. It makes you feel good because you're not hiding anything. And you can be just so transparent. Like, I said what I was doing and I'm actually doing that.
It's like what I tell my kids. You remember less if you don't lie.
Right.
That you had a special case of being pregnant while getting clean. Take us through that, and as you feel this life in you, how did it strengthen your resolve to ultimately stay clean?
So I was actually clean. So well, we did experience miscarriages while I was using.
Right.
And then I got clean in 20.
That's right. In your recovery, you got pregnant during your after your recovery.
Yes. So I was clean 2 years, but my situation is a little bit different and controversial. Just trigger warning really quickly.
Take us through it. Don't worry about the whole trigger thing.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I opted to do medication management. Mm-hmm. They started me off with methadone. That did not work for me because I knew I was going to abuse it. Then they put me on Suboxone, and that was a journey, and it worked wonders for me. It really did. I never ran out of my medications. I never overused. I never did any of those things. However, when I found out I was pregnant, things had to change.
Right.
So I was put on something called Subutex, which is not the best option, but it's healthier for babies.
Right.
And those 9-10 months, because my child just was really comfortable in my body for whatever reason. Just kidding. But he was not trying to leave. But, you know, I had to be prepared for the possibility he was going to be in the hospital for a little bit.
Right.
So what I did was I went, this, please, nobody do what I did. Please follow your doctor's instructions. I'm not a doctor, not any sort of medical professional by any means. But I started to wean myself off of it because I really didn't want him to be in the hospital for a long time. Mm-hmm. Okay. So what I started to do a month beforehand was just kind of take less and less and less and less. Mm-hmm. And he ended up only being in the hospital for like a week, which... that's unheard of. They were thinking he was possibly going through withdrawals. Right. Very slight. It wasn't, he was perfect. He was fine.
But what was your doing the weaning off of that to protect your son? How did that affect your, I don't know if I'm using like the cravings or just the want, did that increase as well while you were pregnant?
Yes.
And that made it kind of dangerous?
Yes.
Were you actually like seeking?
So my son really gave me, he's everything I ever wanted. Sorry.
No, I feel that way about my kids too.
I love him so much. And that was enough for me to not even think, you know, about, it was like a no-brainer.
Right.
I wanted him before he was even a thought. Mm-hmm. You know, I was told I couldn't have children.
Right.
Because of this is why you have tissues. Okay. You know, and,
please, share it with us. You know, everybody who's a parent, yeah, they don't see the different struggles, the different type of deal, just what they go through and maybe some stuff they hear through, but this is something, yeah, you know, they need to know, like, there are parents who go through this.
Mm-hmm.
And they need to feel what you felt going through it so that they know when they see somebody, they don't see them as an unfit parent. They see them as somebody, you know, that they love their kids as much as anybody else.
Yeah. And it's controversial. A lot of people think it's wrong to do medication management.
Mm-hmm.
I get it. You know, it's what worked for me. It's kept me sober.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't want him to, I know withdrawal is really uncomfortable. It's not just physically uncomfortable, but it makes you want to die. You're literally, so what happens when you use drugs is there's a release of serotonin, endorphins, dopamine. When you're going through withdrawal, it's literally completely depleted. You have nothing in you anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So knowing that my son, this little baby coming into the world, could possibly go through something that I've endured so many times,
yeah,
was like torture to me. I never wanted to, like, you just got here. I don't want you to suffer. Like, you know, this is why I started this whole thing. You know, I definitely felt like I wanted to use, you know, and I wanted to, like, I miss drugs more than anything. It sounds terrible, but you know, I've been around women who were using drugs and pregnant, and I would just be like, I would do anything to have a child, and look at what you're doing, you know, and I had a lot of envy and resentment towards them.
Mm-hmm.
It was just like a no-brainer for me. Like, I just, my love for him and the blessed, I just felt really blessed that, first of all, my husband has 3 children from a previous relationship.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I have a good relationship with their mom, and it's a weird dynamic, but it works.
No, it's a positive dynamic. Yeah. That's what everybody should strive for. Yeah. But continue.
And I felt really lucky that he chose me to have, mm-hmm, this child with, after everything he endured and went through,
mm-hmm,
with me. Right. And he still saw me fit to be the mother of his child.
Right.
And he's a really good dad. He puts women to shame. Like, that's how great of a father he is. You know, I've always admired that about him. And, like, I was always really grateful that he allowed me to carry his, like, life that he's put into this world. Like, I was always so honored about that. I don't want to let him down. That's such a trust as a man. Right. You know, you're taking yourself and you're putting it into this woman.
Right.
And you expect that that woman is going to hold that child to term and keep that baby safe.
Right.
I'm sorry. And I owed him that. Okay. After everything he did for me, I owed him that.
Right.
You know, and I didn't want to let him down. I didn't want to let my family down. My mom, my stepdad. Mm-hmm. You know, my stepdad has been such a guiding light in my life. You know, he's a pain in the ass, but I adore him. And he's been there for me since I was a kid, you know, and he's loved me unconditionally. And, you know, he grew attached to this baby that I'm carrying. And my love just for my entire family outweighed anything that I wanted and or felt. And I felt like, well, I'm going to be a mom now. And I have a responsibility. Like, it's not always what you want anymore.
Right.
You know, this is when you start to give up all of those things. And I'll be honest, it's going to sound selfish, but it was difficult because I am an only child. So, you know, I had some tough stuff happen, but, you know, I was kind of used to getting what I wanted when I wanted it.
Mm-hmm.
But my son just, he's everything I've ever wanted in my life. I look at him, I stare at him when he sleeps. He's my whole life.
I'm on the same page or two with that.
The
same, you've seen my boys.
Yes.
And, you know, trust me, it's you get into that type of conversation, that feeling and everything. And, you know, those that don't have yet or decided not to have, they can never understand that parental dynamic of how someone could love their kid. You know, there's a lot of people out there. It was actually one of RG's friend's husband, and he kind of echoed the same thing, and I overheard him saying that to somebody else. And I know a lot of people have probably said it, other people have probably heard it, but parents realize, and it's kind of weird to say, what a good they understand murder.
Yes. Oh yeah.
Because when something like they can rationalize killing someone.
Oh yeah.
And that's, you know, in defense of their children. That
so
that type
true.
Of feeling, like, I will never feel remorse if I have to put you down for my children.
Right.
Because so you're just an afterthought.
Mm-hmm.
If I have to do that to you because I'm defending them.
Right. 100%.
You know? So it's that I definitely get.
Yeah.
So it translates into people feeling that type of emotion and the tears, and so believe me, it's a different dynamic that you do not understand until you are a parent.
Yep, it's true. And, you know, I have my stepchildren. I love them so much. You know I would die for them in a hot minute. My love grew for them after I had my son.
Mm.
It was like I saw them differently. And I was just like, yeah, I would kill everybody for these four kids. Like, yeah, the whole city is gone just for these four. You know, so I completely relate to that. I just love them so much. You know, it's unconceivable. Like, it's just, like, insane. It's an insane type of love. And it's just, I will kill people. Yeah
people they don't like another parent understands that parent face, like,
yep,
are you kidding me? Like, you know, that wow, you know, face. But like the animal from the Muppets, like, you got that face, like, don't go there.
Yeah.
So now, was there anyone who found it hard to see you going through recovery who may not have been optimistic and didn't think it would succeed?
Not that I know of.
Okay.
A lot of people didn't know about my addiction.
Right.
I have lost friends because of what I did while using. And I understood. You know, I completely understood. You have to protect yourself and do what's right for yourself.
Right.
But not that I know. I don't know of anyone who didn't believe I would stay sober. I was never really told or shown that.
Okay.
You know, and I was also really, like, close. It's like in a little rock, I guess, of sorts during that time.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Not anyone listening who is an addict, to those helping friends and family beat addiction, knowing what you've been through, how can they help themselves or each other support the path getting and staying clean? Now we've been, you've touched on, so not to rehash,
mm-hmm.
but there's the support for those supporting and those that can do for themselves. So rather than this being a repetitive question, is there anything else you want to expand that, anything else that could, other than having them the support for themselves, being supportive of those recovering, is there anything that else you might touch base on that we might have left out?
So the you know, and they say this in NA and AA, just take one day at a time. I heard this really good example once, that you take a shower every day, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the shower you took yesterday is not valid for tomorrow and the day before.
Mm-hmm.
So it's important to deal with recovery like that. I'm going to take a shower today and I'll take another one tomorrow, because if I don't take one tomorrow, it doesn't mean the one that I took yesterday is going to help me tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
So you just kind of take it a day-by-day process. Sometimes it's not that simple. Sometimes you may need to take it hour by hour, mm-hmm. minute by minute.
Right.
That's really important when you're going through, especially the beginning of your recovery, because you always feel like it's not ever going to end.
Mm-hmm.
But it will. Okay. You're just maintaining hope and staying patient with yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Just taking one day at a time.
No, that's great. That's all anybody can do.
Right.
Until they reach their goal, hopefully.
It's important, though, not to, like, focus on tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my sponsor used to tell me that. I was like, oh, but what about? And she's like, yeah, I need you to stop thinking about what about tomorrow or later or tonight.
Mm-hmm.
Just focus on right now, you know, because we don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. We're not thinking about staying sober tomorrow. We're thinking about staying sober at this very moment.
Right.
It helps you live in the moment and the present.
Mm-hmm.
That's really important, because as addicts, we become really overwhelmed with, remember, like, focusing on, am I going to have enough drugs for tomorrow? Am I going to have enough drugs for next week? You don't want to keep doing that. We're done with that lifestyle. Just mm-hmm. right now.
Right.
Just right now.
Now, when you feel your son can understand or process your journey, would you share that with him?
Yes. Yes. I never want him to meet that woman, but I definitely want him to know what I experienced. So, you know, I'm in the process of writing a book at the moment. It's mm-hmm. called Letters to My Father. I didn't really have, like, a support for my father's addiction.
Mm-hmm.
And that is kind of like the process of what I went through my father's addiction. But one day my son is gonna pick up a book and be like, all right, what happened here? You know, so I think he should know, especially because, you know, I do a lot of speaking and, you know, I'm kind of a little bit out there, and if you type my name up, stuff will come up.
Mm-hmm.
So I never wanted to be a situation where he's like 10 or 11 and people are like, well, your mom was a drug addict, that he could, mm-hmm. you know, what I want him to be like, she sure was. She sure was. And look at what she's doing now. Look at what we got now. Exactly. And, you know, that's what I want.
Right.
And because kids could be mean, you know. So I want him to be able to just be like, yep, that was my mom, and this is her now. You know, I think it's important that he knows who I was, mm-hmm. but not who I am today, but how I got here.
No, it's great.
Yeah.
Now, you've talked a lot about how your husband has supported you. How does he continue to this day help you maintain your successful sobriety?
He doesn't hold grudges, which I think is just, you know, I had to learn that from him.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't hold my past against me, you know, in regards to recovery.
Mm-hmm.
It was something he always said we.
Right.
It was never like, you have to go through this, or you're going, you did it. Mm-hmm. It was more just, we're going through this.
Showing the,
you
support,
know, he was always my partner. He was never, he never just left me out to dry.
Mm-hmm.
He probably had every right to do so. So, yeah.
And has he done anything in addition to even though it can be considered that, but, you know, helping a loved one, you know, strengthen a recovering addict, the support is there, absolutely. As you said, you know, we're doing this together. He showed that. And strengthening somebody who at a lot of times can be weak, strengthening them through however way possible, as long as it's in a positive way. Now, is there anything you could think of that he's also done to strengthen you as well, other than the support? Because people need to know, a lot of people, when you talk to somebody and they're dealing with somebody who's dealing with this, there's not that much of a good roadmap other than saying, you know, being there for them. You got to be there for them. Like, how the fuck do you do that? Yeah. You know, I'm dealing with somebody who can be difficult. That nobody's the same.
Right.
So the support's not always going to be the same. So anything you could expand on that can help, you know, realize that, hey, look, you know, support is support.
Right. Well, he's very proactive, and he's somebody who's very, like, if you tell him, I want to be a world famous singer, songwriter, he's going to find a way to make sure you become a world famous singer, songwriter. And he's always been really good with that stuff. So, you know, I think you have to kind of go by the person that you're supporting.
Right.
And kind of go and see how their drum is beating, I guess. With him specifically, he went to meetings with me. He went to therapy sessions with me, even though he wouldn't go in, but he would sit outside and wait just to tell me or show me he was there, rather than, you know, physically have to, like, I'm here, you know.
Yeah.
For him, it was more about the showing. Even the little stuff, like, he's had in his phone, he, for the past 7 years, he's had my anniversary, and every anniversary, he literally has a countdown to the next one, and the next one, and the next one. And it's those little things, like when you celebrate the small things, you know, it's really endearing, and it makes you feel good. That first year of recovery, he would tell me, this is the amount of days you have in sobriety. We're almost here at this amount of time. And the first year, he made it just, like, incredible. It was so, it was like, we had a surprise. He had a little cake for me. It was really nice. He baked it. He got the whole family involved, you know, and it just made me feel like, oh, wow, you really see that I did this, you know, and I always say a lot, like, he saved me, and he'll be like, oh, no, you did that, and I do believe that I owe him a lot in regards to my addiction, but he's very quick to never take the credit, ever, he will never take the credit. He's very quick to just be like, you did that. I did not do that. You did it. Right. I still believe that he saved me.
That's a wonderful thing to have in your life.
Yeah.
What is a must a person getting clean should hold on to not lose faith that at the end of the road is a new life to live?
The worst day in addiction. Mm. Whatever your worst day in addiction is, remember that. Like, harp on it. My worst day today will never compare to my best day in addiction. Mm. That's how horrible addiction is.
Right.
It is like hell. Literally, it's Groundhog's Day. But I always think about the worst day I've ever had in addiction. And it reminds me to really stay sober. You know, I remember when I was using heavily. It was the summer before I got clean. It was 2014 maybe, and my mom's best friend, her son passed away from an overdose. And I remember I was going through withdrawals, and I was sitting on the kind of like the stoop, and my mom was hugging her, but she had her back to me, and my mom is looking at me, and she's just staring at me, like, not saying anything, but I know what she's thinking.
Right.
I've never forgotten that look. That look of, like, I need you to get it together. Like, I'm not doing this. I'm not burying you.
Or somebody's going to be hugging me like
this. It spoke volumes, you know, and my stepdad. Like, I remember my stepdad used to take me certain places. He's not an idiot, you know. He's an Army veteran, and he would take me certain places, and I'm just like, why are you so insistent? You know, and you know, I was going to get stuff, but
yeah,
he knew what was going on, but I think he did it to make sure I was safe, because right. I put myself into such bad situations, you know. So they were both really supportive, but they also, I just remember the looks on their faces. I remember everything that they had to do to make sure I was okay. I remember my mom coming into my room, just to check if I was still breathing. Mm. My stepdad would literally lay with me a lot, right. like when I was still living at home, and put his hand on my back to make sure I moved. Like, he was scared, you know?
Wow.
And, you know, I didn't live with my dad, obviously, but my stepdad really was really scared for my life.
Right.
You know, and he definitely did a lot. But I think what keeps me there is remembering the worst day in addiction and remembering the looks on their faces and that pain
right.
that they endured.
Mm. That's really strong words to hold on to.
And I'll never forget the look on my mom's face that day, and I'll never forget the disappointment in my stepdad's eyes
right.
when I walked back to the car that day. We knew, we didn't say anything, yeah. but he looked so disappointed in me.
Mm.
And I was just like, damn. And it hurt me to hurt him.
Yeah. No, that's very, very strong words.
Yeah.
What are additional resources someone can take advantage of here? We're in New York, or in the U.S. or another country, that they can mirror and discover that they're, you know, that they're, wherever they are, what it has to offer to help get clean at any level of addiction.
So, you know, if anybody does have insurance, there is a behavioral health line on the back of their card. That is really important. They're very good about not judging. Mm.
Is that strictly for addiction, or
there's different parts to it. So it's behavioral health, so they'll ask you, do you need assistance with addiction, mental health, suicide? Like, so there's different kind of departments in
okay.
it. And this is any insurance card, any at all.
Mm, okay.
Or you can just kind of Google addiction help. One thing I always tell people is if they're going through withdrawals and they really want to kind of keep going with it,
right.
check yourself into an ER immediately. They will keep you for the 3 to 4 days. They right. have to, and help you go through the detox, and they'll help you go through it so it's not uncomfortable.
Right.
So with that also, though, you want to try and the city hospitals are best.
Mm-hmm.
Mount Sinai. I believe St. Joseph's is here in Yonkers, I believe, or St. John's.
Riverside, St. John, Riverside.
St. John's. Yeah. They have an addiction unit, so right. it's easier to get help there.
Yeah.
They'll just send you right upstairs, and it's they're pretty good about it.
Okay.
It's gotten better. When I was going through some, you know, when I was going through the whole process of my beginnings of recovery, when I was just kind of back and forth,
right.
it wasn't simple because they didn't see that as an issue. Because they thought it was just the pills.
Right.
Now it's different. They're taking it very seriously.
Mm-hmm.
Montefiore, they'll do the detox with you.
Okay.
Lebanon will definitely get you set up for like a week.
So definitely check the resources that a hospital nearby you, because even though we are referencing in the New York area,
but right.
Have you dealt with anybody regionally or internationally? That
yes.
you may have had to research something for them because they weren't in the know.
Yes. So my day job is I work for an ATI program, and I do a lot of court. And
ATI,
Alternative to Incarceration.
Okay.
So I get kids out of jail pretty much. We try to kind of like rehabilitate.
Mm-hmm.
But I come into contact with a lot of people in addiction.
Okay.
There's a direct correlation between crime and addiction.
Okay.
It's a thing. So, you know, I've had a few people in it. I've had one kid that I still work with to this day. He's from Puerto Rico.
Right.
And I was able to get him assistance, but he has Medicaid, so it was a little different.
Okay.
And we got him help in Pennsylvania.
Nice.
So we sent him off to Pennsylvania. That was helpful with my job. But if you Google Bronx Directory of Services, uh-huh, or Queens or Yonkers, whatever borough or city or town you're in, mm-hmm, every town has it. Just if you live in Croton-on-Hudson, let's just say Croton-on-Hudson Directory of Services, uh-huh, it's a PDF. It'll pop right up and you can literally look for free addiction help. Mm. And they will help you through the process, and it's seamless. Like, I mean, I know for the city, and they're a little rough in the city, so I imagine that,
yeah,
in Westchester would be a little bit easier.
Mm-hmm.
But they will help you, and okay, usually, you know, they do like sliding scale fee, or you let them know you don't have an income, and they will try their best to work with you.
Okay. Any chance you've dealt with anybody internationally or not yet? Because I know different countries do this in different ways, and they normally don't tend to shine because it's not the way they do it in the U.S.
Yeah.
And have you seen any type of success internationally, how they dealt with addiction?
Yes, Canada. So Canada deals, actually, I was doing like mentoring,
uh-huh,
with a young lady from Canada. We kind of connected through an addiction group.
Right.
So, and we still keep in contact. She's been sober for 5 months now, which I think is amazing. I wish I could share her name, but, you know. But they do it very differently in Canada and right, a lot of European countries as well. They do it more of in a harm reduction sense where, okay, you know, in the U.S., we're more like cold turkey stop or medication management, which I swear by. But in Canada, they prefer harm reduction. So they have locations where you can actually go use safely. And they have case managers and caseworkers that help you slowly decrease, you know, based on your goals. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And it seems to work because there's a big decrease in their population of people who are addicted,
right,
especially to opiates.
Okay.
So I've seen, I mean, from what I see statistically, it seems to be a, you know, helpful, but
yeah,
I don't live in Canada, but you know, from what I see, I'm
sure it's working. The numbers can be easily looked up.
Right.
And that's great. Now, any final thoughts, shout outs, anything you want to mention? Also let people know how they can, you know, view your continued journey and all your resources and everything. I mean, what do you got?
So I just wanted to thank you guys again. I know I'm a baby, I cry a lot. But I really appreciate it so much. You know, the past few years have been a little rough, so I really appreciate this opportunity. My Instagram is Inspiration. It's kind of like a play on my name.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of it being with an I, it's in. So it's ENN, Spiration, SPIRATIONS. And
we also follow each other on IG. So
right,
if you didn't get that, then check out who I follow and you will definitely find her.
And so I definitely kind of, you know, I do motivational speaking. I share a lot about where I am mentally, and some days are not good and some days are great.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, it's so weird because my mom is like, she's a very in your face type of person, and I'm not, I try not to be like that. We're very different, very similar but very different.
Mm-hmm.
But one day she had told me that somebody had asked her, like, oh, how are you so open about sharing your experiences and about your daughter?
Mm-hmm.
And she said, I don't know, I just like to, you know, change people's lives through the power of testimony.
Mm-hmm.
And I ran with that. And that is my mission statement, changing people's lives through the power of testimony.
Awesome.
You know, so, but definitely follow me on Instagram. You know, I'm on the journey. This is a journey that never ends.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when once you're in addiction, you're always in addiction. But once you're in recovery, you're always supported in recovery.
Absolutely.
And sorry, I'm so emotional. But I feel really blessed. You know, I always tell people that if God or you know, the creator, whatever, you know, came down and was like, yo, Anovi, I need you to do that one more time because we missed somebody that right, you could have helped. I'm like, oh, man. All right. Sucks.
Let's do this.
You know, and I'll do it. But, you know, I do believe that that we go through everything for a reason. Right. And I've been really grateful to have seen success in helping people and have been told mm-hmm. that people have changed their lives because of the things that I've shared.
Right.
You know, I think right now I'm on to chapter 2, I guess, of my journey in recovery, and that's dealing with my father's death. Mm. And that's hard.
Yeah.
So that's what I'm working on right now. And, you know, my dad always told me I didn't think I could be a mom. Right. And he's like, it's all right. You're gonna have... The whole world is going to be your child, mm. you know, and I was like, all right, Dad. And I guess, you know, I always end off with a saying, and I do explain the saying in my Instagram. So make sure you check that out, but keep doing what you do so we could do what we do. We got this.
We certainly do. And thank you again for joining me on my journey and doing what we do to help everyone in any way possible, and any little bit, if it helps anybody, I think it's a wonderful thing. And thank you for being a part of my journey.
Thank you so much. This was really powerful.
And I appreciate it, and I'm glad I was able to put you in a space to share your story in such a comfortable way. Even though nobody sees the setup, nobody sees how we do it. It's a lot of work, but I always love the end result. And this is an amazing thing.
Yes.
And thank you for being an extremely wonderful chapter of this podcast and sharing your story. And once the book comes out, please come back and, you know, we'll talk on that and just have another amazing time.
Thank you. I'm honored. I'm really honored. Genuinely, thank you.
And anybody listening, I want to say thank you again and continue to tune in. And if you yourself have a story to tell, if you know anybody, by all means, please reach out to me at FYI I Am Damage on Instagram, FYI I Am Damage at Gmail. By all means, please, if you feel the strength from this episode and it empowers you to want to tell your story, hit me up and we'll see. We'll tell your story to the world. We'll share your strength with the world and little by little make everybody a little bit stronger to move forward. Pa'lante. Thank you, everybody. This is FYI, I Am Damaged.
And I'm a Novi, FYI, I Am Damaged.
Thank you, everybody. Take care.